Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
It's Freddie Prinze Jr. and Jeff Dye back in the ring. Wrestling with Freddie makes its triumphant return for an electrifying fourth season. Hey, Jeff, are you ready to rumble our way into an all-new season of Wrestling with Freddie?
You better believe I have. I've been practicing my body slams, and I'm jacked.
All right, don't go injuring yourself now. We'll be highlighting the best stories and matches of the week in wrestling from AEW, WWE, and have one-on-one talks with the best talents in the world of pro wrestling.
Listen to Wrestling with Freddie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Volume.
The 82-game preseason is in the books, and now it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered with same-game parlays, live betting, odds boosts, and so much more. The Boston Celtics are currently the favorite at plus 160, but the team that's third in my championship rankings, the Dallas Mavericks, you can get them on DraftKings right now at plus 1600 to win the title. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code HOOPS. That's H-O-O-P-S. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code HOOPS, H-O-O-P-S, only on DraftKings. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY to 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas. 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario, bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources. All right, welcome to Hoops Tonight here at The Volume. Happy Friday, everybody. Hope all of you guys are having an incredible week. We got an amazing show for you today. We're going to do a good old-fashioned obituary on the Los Angeles Lakers. Technically, it's not over, but I have a feeling they're going to get swept on Saturday. I don't think they have the fight to beat these guys, especially after how they looked in that third quarter. Maybe I'll be wrong. Maybe they'll get one, but no matter what, NBA history tells us that the Los Angeles Lakers are done. So we're going to talk a little bit about what separates them from the Denver Nuggets and where they go from here. And I can't think of anybody better than a good friend of mine and somebody who covers the Lakers for The Athletic, Mr. Jovan Buha. You guys know him. He's been on the show a bunch. We're going to break it all down. You guys know the drill before we get started. Subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel so you don't miss any more of our videos. Follow me on Twitter at @_JasonLT so you guys don't miss any show announcements. Don't forget about our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts under Hoops Tonight. Keep dropping mailbag questions in the YouTube comments. We're going to hit a couple mailbags a week throughout the end of the season. And last but not least, before we get started, as I've been saying, this is the time of year when you got to get out and see these guys playing in person. LeBron James, like, it's very possible that Saturday is his last playoff game that he ever plays. It's that certainly on the table. And like, as great as it is watching these games on TV, there's nothing like being there in person, especially during the intensity of the NBA playoffs. This is where I want to talk to you guys about Game Time, an amazing ticket buying experience. They have all-in pricing, so you don't have to worry about going to check out and then all of a sudden getting surprised by a much larger number than you were expecting. It's not a convoluted process. You can check out in as soon as two taps. And they also have a view of your seat that you can see within the app, so you know what you're buying and know what you're going to get when you show up to the arena. They also have exclusive flash deals and sponsored deals on tickets for football, basketball, baseball, concerts, comedy, theater, and more. And with zone deals, you pick the section and Game Time picks the seats for you in that section with big time savings. So take the guesswork out of buying tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app, create an account, and use code HOOPS for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem code HOOPS. That's HOOPS for $20 off. Download Game Time today. Last minute tickets, lowest price guaranteed. All right, Jovan. So in this, you know, obviously disappointing start to this series, I think it's also been deeply informative. It's been confirming of some of the things that we've thought throughout the season. But I want to kind of start with the Nuggets a little bit, because in the Lakers' pursuit of trying to address these issues, whether it's them trying to reconfigure around LeBron and AD this offseason to try to make another run at it, or if it's a pivot, I think a great team for them to try to emulate is the Denver Nuggets, a team that I think is not just the defending champion, but I think the legitimate favorite this year for a reason, and a team that I believe has a real chance to go on an extended dynastic run here. And so what has this series taught you about the difference between a real championship team like the Nuggets and the Lakers?
Well, to me, it's been the killer instinct of the Denver Nuggets. Before the game, I asked Nuggets head coach Michael Malone, you've beaten this team 10 straight times. Like, how do you battle the complacency with your group just not thinking we're going to show up and beat this team, because we've done it 10 times in a row? And at some point, human nature starts to kick in with a certain level of complacency, even in a playoff setting. And he essentially said, you know, as a coach, that is what I have to battle. And the message has been, we were down 12 in game one. We were down 20 in game two. We're now on the road. We're facing a hostile crowd. And, you know, the Lakers want to beat us after losing 10 straight times. So the message is, don't get off to a slow start. Don't turn the ball over and keep the crowd out of the game. And the Nuggets did none of those things to start that game. The Lakers got off to an 8-0 run. The crowd was as loud as I've heard it all season. It was, you know, a deafening pitch, and it was the start that the Lakers needed if they were going to win a game against the Nuggets. And lo and behold, in my opinion, Denver had their worst half of the series in that first half of game three, turning the ball over, missing open threes, and really just struggling on both ends, yet they were only down four. Then they opened the second half with a 24-10 run. And to me, this team has just won the mental game against the Lakers. They have gotten stronger in second halves. They've outscored the Lakers by 31 points through the three third quarters in this series, plus 42 overall in the second half. So we've seen it. The Lakers have thrown their bench, their best punch early, and they've gotten out to these double-digit leads. They've led at halftime in all three games. They've led at halftime in 7 of the 11 consecutive losses to Denver. And then Denver just takes over in the second half. It's the same movie on repeat, but for Denver to have that level of just killer instinct and seriousness and professionalism and lack of complacency to do the same thing over and over again, and regardless of LeBron's getting downhill in transition, AD's cooking them with 14 consecutive made shots in game two. Like, they don't care. They run their offense the same way. Everybody is locked in. They play team basketball on both ends. And you don't see guys complaining. You don't see guys pointing fingers. You don't see guys going at the refs. And they just play a serious brand of basketball. It reminds me a lot of ways of the San Antonio Spurs and the way that they built that dynasty of, didn't matter who's doing what. Like, obviously, you had Tim Duncan as the head of the snake. In this case, it's Nikola Jokic. You had Tony Parker and Jamal Murray is the analog there, but just the level of no matter what's happening, they're never rattled. And that's why you see them close a game to making seven consecutive shots against the Lakers. Like, they are one of the best crunch time teams I've ever seen, period. I think, like, we could talk about where they rank all time, and I think they're higher than I think most people would assume at this point. But to me, the crunch time, the focus, and just the mental advantage that they've had on the Lakers through these 11 straight wins, that to me has been what has stood out the most.
Yeah, you know, that specific piece about that first half and that being one of the worst halves they've played, I agree as it pertains to their ceiling, but their floor is still so high. And that first half was really a great example in the sense that, like, no matter what, whether or not MPJ's hitting the threes he normally hits, or if Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic and their kind of decision making is as sharp or as sloppy as it can get from time to time, like, Aaron Gordon is still 6'10", freaky athletic, and working underneath the basket. And so, like, even though, like even if you look within that first half, like, the Lakers were sharp in a lot of areas in that first half. But a specific area where they were weak is LeBron James on the back line was just doing a really poor job of reading that, like, there is a read and react with that low man position, in the sense that, like, there, you do have help responsibilities, but you also have Aaron Gordon responsibilities, and you kind of have to toe that line between the two. And for the record, in the first two games, I thought LeBron was really good in that role. But I don't know if it was just, I don't know if LeBron lost faith after the collapse in game two. I don't know if it was just literally just a bad night, but literally from the opening tip, he just wasn't as sharp in that specific area. And so, like, it's like the Lakers had all these areas kind of tied up in that first half, but that one opening, Aaron Gordon just smashed through and dominated the first half of that game, right? Like, there was a, like, Jamal Murray, even though he was relatively inefficient throughout the series, he just had these little stretches in each series where he was really good. I thought his shot making was really good in the third quarter of game one, obviously down the stretch in crunch time of game two. I thought in the second quarter, early second quarter of game three, he just hit a bunch of timely shots, right? And, like, one of the things with Denver is their floor is so high that, like, even if you manage to kind of outplay them for stretches, as soon as you dip, and if they just start to gain ground, right? And then, honestly, I thought Denver threw a really good punch in that early third quarter stretch, and then you could just literally see the Lakers, like, go the rope. And that's where I want to get to the part you talked about with being serious and being professional, because that to me was the biggest thing that stood out to me about this particular matchup. The stuff about floor versus ceiling, that to me is more of a total first round kind of, like, takeaway. In general, I think we're learning that, like, players with higher floors are more valuable in the postseason than players with higher ceilings. KCP doesn't have the ceiling that D'Lo has, but night in, night out in the playoffs, he's just a more impactful player. His floor is higher, right? But as we go to the seriousness, when it comes to the Nuggets, they're one of the most important parts about a championship team, in my opinion, is, like, the discipline and focus on a possession-by-possession basis by each player within what their job is and what they're expected to do. Aaron Gordon, after the game, talked about this. Like, I'm just doing what my team needs to win. He dominated that game not by dominating offensive possessions, not by being this devastating on-ball defensive threat that was just putting his offensive player in jail. No, he just, his job within the scheme is to kind of, like, clean up stuff on the back line offensively and clean up stuff on the back line defensively. And like, he just capitalized on what was happening within that game. And he kind of broke through that opening, like we talked about, right? He did his job. And within that context, he was the hero of that particular game. But he wasn't trying to be the hero. He's just doing his job. Every single one of these guys has a job. Even Michael Porter Jr., as gifted as he is offensively, like, one of the most important roles he has on this team is he's a dominant rebounder. And that's what they got. 49 points and 25 rebounds out of Michael Porter Jr. and Aaron Gordon last night. That's completely insane. And when you look over at the Lakers side of it, it's like there's always these random possessions where a random player will just kind of bite off more than he can chew offensively and take an overly difficult shot. There is like 10, 15 possession stretches where they're really laser focused on all the details. And then there's 10, 15 possession sequences where they're not. It's not a consistent part of their basketball character. And when you talk about professionalism and serious basketball, to me, it's about that possession by possession, do your job every single time. If you see them make a mistake or go off script, it's usually like they'll do it once and then Mike Malone will lose his mind and yell at them. And then they're right back on track by the next possession. And like, that just was not, and ironically, and this is the last thing I'll say about it, it ironically reminded me of just the entire Laker regular season, which was like, if you caught them on the right night and you watched them, you're like, this team has championship potential. Look at how serious these guys are. Look at how focused they are. This is what they're capable of. But then two nights later against Brooklyn, they would just be terrible. You know, like they were never a team that could hold on to the rope consistently, like a real championship team for the entirety of the season. You know what I mean? And so within these games, if you watched a 10-minute sequence, you'd be like, man, the Lakers are right there with Denver. But then eventually they'd let go of the rope and Denver's serious approach would take over. And I think it was really, really informative, not just about what the Nuggets are and what makes them so great, but also just like team building and coaching and different aspects like that, that I think set that are preventing the Lakers from getting where they need to go. On that note, kind of moving towards the role players, obviously that was the biggest gap in this series. I pulled the numbers last night. I'll pull them up again here in just a second, but it was a complete and total outclassing by the guys down the roster. As a matter of fact, non-LeBron AD Lakers had 131 points and 56 rebounds through three games. Non-Murray Jokic Nuggets had 180 points and 83 rebounds. So what did you learn specifically about the Laker role players in this series, and where do you think they fell short compared to the championship baseline?
First, to me, the Lakers are just too small, and that was a concern for me entering the season, and I think that has played out specifically in this matchup. If you look at the starting lineups and compare them head-to-head at each nominal position, the Nuggets have the size and physicality advantage at all five spots. Nikola Jokic is bigger and stronger than Anthony Davis. Aaron Gordon is bigger and slightly stronger than LeBron James. I think they're pretty similar, but he's slightly bigger.
Aaron's about an inch taller. Yeah.
Yeah. He's about an inch taller. And like, I mean, in terms of who's won the paint battle, battling for rebounds and stuff, like Aaron Gordon has dominated that. So, Michael Porter Jr. is not as strong as Rui Hachimura, but he's taller than him and he has dominated the rebounding battle. You just mentioned it last night. MPJ had 10 rebounds. Rui Hachimura had two, and MPJ did play more minutes, but it was about a 10 minute difference. So it wasn't like enough of a difference to warrant the 8-rebound gap there. Austin Reeves and KCP are similar sizes, but KCP plays with more verve and physicality and just more athleticism. And then D'Angelo Russell versus Jamal Murray. I think that one I don't even have to go into, but Jamal, you know, similar sizes again, but Jamal plays with a certain level of toughness and physicality. So like, just that's before you got to get to the bench and like Peyton Watson, Christian Brown, these guys are coming in, hounding ball handlers, getting offensive rebounds, blocking shots, finishing in transition. So like, I thought the Lakers got dominated from, I mean, we talked about the mental side and clearly Denver has them in a psychological chokehold there. But on the physical side, like Denver is just bigger, they're stronger, they're more athletic, and they use their physicality in a better way. Like I think something that hasn't been talked about enough is Denver's won the free throw battle in two of these three games. And like, that's supposed to be one of the few strengths the Lakers had over Denver, was they get to the free throw line way more than them. They don't foul as much, obviously. So like the Lakers, and I know you've touched on the free throw differential before, but like that is an advantage for the Lakers, based on how they play offensively and how they don't foul. Yet Denver's won the free throw battle in two of the three games. They've won the points in the paint battle in two of the three games. So Denver has beaten the Lakers. Like they've played their style of basketball, but they've also beaten the Lakers at their own game. And when the Lakers have played smaller front lines or like size front lines, they dominate them and they kick their ass and they look great. When they play a team that's bigger than them, it's been the opposite. And I think for me, the fact that the Jackson Hayes was a DNP CD in game three just shows like the Lakers never really addressed the backup center spot. Jackson had some nice moments over the last couple months of the season. Christian Wood, to me, like never really panned out and shot 31% on threes, had some good moments as like a rebounder and defensively. I think about like Kevin Durant against the Suns, but like that was the beginning of the season. And you know, I think Christian Wood overall was a bit of a disappointment. So the fact that the Lakers never really added another big man that was defensive minded, you know, a clear plus rebounder, a guy who could just innings eat for 8 to 15 minutes and spell AD and defend Jokic and give him a few hard fouls, similar to what Dwight Howard did in the 2020 series. Like that to me, what was a weakness of this roster. And the fact that Rui Hachimura in an elimination game is playing 28 minutes and you're going small with Torian Prince at the four, or you're going with these three guard lineups and you're giving up all these offensive rebounds. And again, just getting physically dominated. Like part of that's on the coaching staff and the way that they're deploying these guys. But part of that is a roster construction issue. So to me, biggest takeaway overall was just too small. But also, I think just not good enough. And if we're ranking the starting lineups in terms of the best players in the series, like 5 through 7, 5 through 8 might be all of the rest of the Nuggets starting lineup. And the fact that they arguably have the two best players in the series, depending on, you know, especially in crunch time, obviously with Jamal, but like they have the best player. Jamal has outplayed LeBron and AD for stretches. And then you have Aaron Gordon, KCP and MPJ all thoroughly outplaying Austin, D'Lo, and Rui. Like that just can't happen. And I even think the bench outplayed LA's bench. Like I think Christian Brown and Payton Watson have been more impactful than anyone off the Lakers bench, just with, again, their defense, their rebounding, their energy, and their finishing in transition. So like from top to bottom, and then the coaching, the adjustments, like Denver has decisively won this. I think it's even been more of a gap than the scoreboard indicates. So I just think Denver is bigger and they're better.
No, I agree. The piece about the role players off the bench, actually, like Christian Brown and Payton Watson, kind of brings me back to that seriousness and professionalism piece. Like those two guys just come in and it's like, all we need you to do is be athletic wrecking balls within the context of these specific responsibilities on the floor. Those dudes come in and they buy in and they do it. And so once again, those guys have a certain floor. Like you can expect Christian Brown and Payton Watson to have a certain amount of impact just with their athleticism. Whereas it's like, okay, Spencer Dinwiddie checked in. It's like, maybe these threes will go in, you know, and it's and we'll see what happens, right? I also the bit about Jackson Hayes, like in the moment last night, I'm sitting there thinking like this to me was one of the fundamental issues with Darvin Ham during the entire Darvin Ham experience, and we're going to talk about Darvin in a bigger context later, but he just always defaulted more towards offensive skill and speed and not towards size and athleticism, and I thought last night when the chips were down, him being like no Jackson, just a lot more three guard lineups was a pretty strong indicator of like Darvin's kind of basketball philosophy, which I think is flawed. And then also like that within this particular matchup, that was a death wish. And one of the problems too is, you know, the Lakers just their guards weren't playing well. So like you're leaning into guard play when your guards are getting their ass kicked. It didn't make any sense to me in the moment, but you know, you mentioned size. I agree. I think it's a little deeper than size, and it I would just call it like overall physicality, in the sense that it's not just height. It's even at these specific positions, these guys play with more force. Like you mentioned KCP versus Austin Reeves. Like Austin, and we're going to talk about Austin. Like I thought Austin and Rui were trying to do their jobs. I just thought they didn't play well. Like Austin and Rui both just had nightmare series. I saw that clip of Austin hugging Phil Handy, and it looked like he said, "It's my fault." And like you could just tell he was heartbroken. And I felt bad for Austin because like Austin really defended Jamal Murray well for the first 7 quarters of this series. And I thought he did his job. He just couldn't make shots. And Rui, I thought, was given a really difficult role too, to guard Jokic to start the series. And you could tell that kind of sapped him of his confidence, and then he was just never able to regather it. But like other than those guys, it was a lot of unserious basketball. But above and beyond that, it was the lack of physical force that they could bring to the table. KCP brings physical force. Aaron Gordon brings physical force. MPJ with his length brings physical force to the table. Christian Brown brings physical force. Payton Watson brings physical force. Austin doesn't. That's not in his toolkit. D'Lo doesn't. That's not in his toolkit. Rui does, but they stuck him consistently in matchups in this series where he couldn't, you know, because they were basically using him to eat up minutes, right, on Jokic for about half the series to this point. But like, Spencer Dinwiddie is probably the best athlete of the role players, and he's not a very good athlete, right? Gabe Vincent has a certain force that he brings, but he's just small, you know? And so like that to me was the big thing that stood out. It just is like, down the roster, there's just not enough physical force. And when you go back and you look at the 2020 Lakers, that was a huge element of what made them great. Alex Caruso, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Dwight Howard, Kyle Kuzma. That was a huge part of what made them great. Even Danny Green. He was just a big, strong two guard, right? And, you know, honestly, it was funny when I was looking back, when I look back at kind of the last few years, even if you just erase one singular mistake, like, there was a lot of panic trades and stupid stuff that happened over the last couple of years. But if they had just held on to Caruso, which, by the way, wouldn't have cost you any asset or anything. It would have just cost money out of Jeannie Buss's pocket. A lot of money because of the luxury tax, but money. And money that probably she would have recouped through the success of the team, in my opinion. So if they just had Caruso and you're looking at Austin Alex as your backcourt instead of Austin D'Lo, fundamentally changes the athletic profile of the team, slots everybody into easier roles defensively. Now, instead of Austin have to chase around to Jamal Murray, it's Alex Caruso chasing around Jamal Murray. And instead of D'Lo and him be, you know, space cadet trying to chase around KCP, it's Austin Reeves, who's a very focused defender, who would be guarding KCP, and then everything makes so much more sense. And so there's a lot to dig into with the eulogy here, but like that piece about physical force off the ball, especially when within the context of the physicality of the postseason, shines through.
Attention all wrestling aficionados. Wrestling with Freddie makes its triumphant return for an electrifying fourth season. This is Freddie Prinze Jr., and I am beyond thrilled to announce that our wrestling extravaganza is back, and joining me once again is the one and only Jeff Dye.
Get ready as we highlight the most jaw-dropping matches, dissect the fiercest feuds, and uncover the latest twists and turns in the world of pro wrestling.
We're dusting off our legendary side quests and unleashing a barrage of brand new segments that will keep you guys on the edge of your seat, like our talks on Unsanctioned Thursdays.
Freddie, you know we gotta give the people what they want. This season, we have an all-star lineup of special guests who are gonna be gracing our podcast, bringing with them their own unique insights, experiences, and all of that in the world of pro wrestling and beyond.
Whether you're a seasoned wrestling veteran or a fresh-faced newcomer, we promise an experience like no other. So buckle up, wrestling fans. Listen to Wrestling with Freddie as part of the My Cultura podcast network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
NFL Total Access, the podcast, is getting you ready for the 2024 NFL Draft. I'm your host, Andrew Levy, and I'll be delivering two shows a week to make sure you're caught up on the very latest NFL news, including every free agency move and how it changes the draft needs of your favorite team. Draft experts and talent scouts, mock drafts, and a few shock drafts, too. NFL Total Access, the podcast, is already on the clock on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What did you make of D'Lo's night last night? Where are you at with D'Lo as a player? And where do you think the team and the organization is at with D'Lo right now?
I mean, I just don't know how you can move forward with D'Lo on this roster if you consider yourself a serious championship contender, or at least have serious championship aspirations, because this is now two out of the three games in this series where he's been harmful. And I think he was actually probably more harmful in game one because he was taking possessions away from LeBron and AD, and to me, calling his own number a little bit too frequently. and, you know, did have a poor shooting night, but I thought more so, I thought inside the arc this series, he was oddly, you know, kind of calling it like looking for those little mid-range pull-ups and step backs and fadeaways that he never was able to create separation with. So they always ended up being either, you know, contests from the front side or rear view contests where a KCP, a Christian Brown, a Peyton Watson were able to stick with him, slither around the pick and roll, and then bother him from behind. So I thought like the 3-point shooting is what it is. Like he got a bunch of good looks, didn't convert. But to me, him kind of calling his own number in the pick and roll, what was ultimately harmful, and he just was never able to create the separation necessary to make those shots, because to me, D'Lo is a guy who does need a level of separation. And if you can get into his airspace, you are going to bother him, as we've seen in this series. But to me, it's been 6 of the 7 games in these, in the last 2 playoff series against Denver. Go back and look at the Western Conference Finals. He was bad in all 4 games. He's been bad in 2 of the 3 games. Got benched last night. There was the video clip of him off to the side of the huddle. He does do that sometimes, but I think optically that was a terrible time to do that. And he just looked incredibly disengaged at that point. He ducked out on media last night. We requested him. He declined to speak. He also declined a couple times in the Western Conference Finals, declined at times earlier this season. So like when he's not playing well and things aren't going well, he kind of ducks out. And I think that, just that in the like, you know, and he's not bringing, like we talked about, you just mentioned Austin and Rui and how those guys just had tough series, like, but they were still trying and trying to do their job and being competitive. And I look at Austin of like, how much has defending Jamal Murray and chasing him around screens and getting smacked by Nikola Jokic in screens, like how much has that sapped his legs and affected him? And I think Austin, he's had a couple games, a couple good rebounding games. He's been competitive defensively. And I think even though he's missed shots, he's brought the requisite competitiveness and spirit. That has not been the case with D'Lo. And you've seen him shrink, I think, in both Game 1 and Game 3. And even in Game 2, I thought he got off to a hot start. Obviously had the 6 threes in the first half, ends up making 7, but had a very quiet second half and rest of the way. So I think this has exposed a bit of the ceiling on the Austin D'Lo pairing. I think those two probably have to be split up, as we had kind of talked about at times this season. I don't think you can have those two be your backcourt. I think a guy like an Alex Caruso or someone with a bit more force and maybe a bit more defense would fit better next to an Austin. But to me, like you and I talked about this, and I will read through the comments on our videos. And sometimes there are people going at us for, you know, you guys don't like D'Lo. You know, D'Lo's clearly the third best player. Like, I don't want to hear that anymore. D'Lo is never the third best player.
The fuck out of here with that.
Austin Reeves is better than him. He's a better playoff performer than him. And it's not to make it an Austin D'Lo thing. It's just that there was a reason why we were talking about the Lakers trading him. There's a reason why the Lakers were strongly considering trading him for most of the season. So in terms of where they go from here, D'Lo has an $18.7 million player option. I think he's cost himself money with this series. I think like you can still make the case he's a $20 to $25 million a year player. I don't know if that is a $20 to $25 million player on a good team, on a contending team. I don't think it is. But if you're a lottery team or a team looking to kind of take the next step into, you know, maybe we're a 9-10 seed and we want to be like a 7-8 seed, I think D'Lo makes sense for you. So I would not be surprised if he still has a competitive market this summer. But if you're the Lakers and you are serious about trying to win a championship, I do not see how you can make any reasonable argument to bring back D'Angelo Russell when you know Denver's not going anywhere. They're going to be here for the next 3 to 4 years, and you're going to have to go through them to win a championship. And I just don't think he can play in a series against Denver, which is really like a conference finals, final series. I think he's fine first round, second round against normal teams. And even then, he's a bit up and down. But against serious, high-level conference finals, finals teams, I don't think you can play him. And that's a problem for a guy that the Lakers have been kind of billing as their third guy. And he's just completely shrunk. And this is honestly not that surprising. We saw it last year. We've seen it at times with him in the playoffs. And I think the Lakers, whether it's a sign and trade, whether it's letting him walk, or whether it's he opts in and trading him, like, I think you have to move on. It's just a matter of how that happens and when it happens.
Yeah, you know, when it comes to D'Lo, I think you and I both were aware of this going into the postseason. If you go back to the trade deadline, you and I both talked about, like, we already know that this Austin D'Lo pairing has a certain ceiling to it. And by the way, going into the regular season, you and I were like, Lakers are a second tier championship contender. And if they make a trade to address the Austin D'Lo pairing, which we knew was flawed after the Denver series last year, then they might be able to enter into that top tier. If they were to get a Bruce Brown, if they were to get a DeJounte Murray, a real athletic two-way player at that two-guard position, right? Like, how much better would DeJounte Murray have been in this series for the Lakers to try to hang? Just think about what we watched over the last three games and replace D'Lo with DeJounte Murray and just imagine how different the series looks. It's very, very different on so many different levels, right? Not only does DeJounte guard Jamal Murray the whole series, he's a guy that brings dribble penetration, which would have helped a lot within these half-court kind of slow-down environments. The two-man game that him and LeBron could have had in a lot of these situations, it would have been really effective, right? Now, here's the thing. I'm not talking about the deadline per se, because here's the thing. I think the Lakers went after DeJounte and couldn't get him. So I'm not trying to criticize the front office in that specific context. My point is just we knew Austin D'Lo had a ceiling. And we knew that if they could have upgraded D'Lo, they would have been better off. They couldn't because of just the landscape and I don't think they could have gotten Bruce Brown either, just by virtue of the price tag and all of this stuff. So you and I kind of went into this postseason knowing like they got their puncher's chance if you happen to get a really hot D'Lo performance, but there's not really much there. And like the what's really stood out to me with D'Lo is he took his humiliation at the hands of Bruce Brown last year. And he took it into the offseason and worked on his ceiling. I think he worked on his jump shot. He worked on some of his pick and roll playmaking stuff. And he definitely went up a level this year. D'Lo played the best basketball of his career in the springtime. There's no doubt. But he never addressed his floor. And this is where I think the criticism is fair, because D'Lo talked a big game. Not only in this series did he say after game two that he thought that they were still going to win, but if we go back a few months after a big night, he talked about how he wanted all the smoke. Straight up said it. He said he wanted all the smoke. Go back to the beginning of the season. He was in the training camp pressers, the media day interview, saying, the guy I want to emulate is Derek White. He's the guy I want to be like. No, you don't. Derek White didn't put in work to address his own individual ceiling. Derek White's floor is what makes him great. It's all about his focus and attention to detail in the margins of the game, not how good he is running a pick and roll or how good he is attacking closeouts or hitting spot up threes. That's not what made Derek White great. And so D'Lo talked about all this stuff, but it's abundantly clear with what happened that he doesn't actually get it. And because he leaned into his ceiling, there was a certain volatility with him. And it's interesting because if you actually go back, the Lakers have played a bunch of big games in a row. They've played seven massive regular season games, or eight massive games in a row, right? You have the Golden State game. D'Lo was abysmal. You have the Minnesota game. D'Lo was abysmal. And those were really important games. If you win one of those games, you're the sixth seed and you're playing Minnesota right now. And I would have picked the Lakers to beat Minnesota. You win one of those games, okay? Yeah. Instead, you get two stinkers. He doesn't play well, right? Plays really well against the Pelicans in both games, right? We can agree on that. Then he's abysmal in game one, pretty good in game two, abysmal in game three. So like four times in this last seven game stretch where they were playing all of these monumentally important games, he was not just bad, but like damaging bad. And that's the problem, is it's not the ceiling. We all know what D'Lo's ceiling is. His floor is just so incredibly low. And when we talk about the offseason, I actually disagree with you as it pertains to him being a $20, $25 million player. Maybe I'll be wrong. And maybe it'll be a bad team that swoops in and offers him some money. I do think he has some value as a regular season skill guard. A lot of value as a regular season skill guard. I think you can probably bank on 50 pretty good games out of him. And that's going to give you a chance to hold some ground in the standings. But like when I really look at an NBA team looking at skill guards that are not necessarily guys that you're going to lean on in your closing five in a big playoff game, the market last year for that type of player, that was kind of the Gabe Vincent, Dennis Schroeder tier, right? Like, and those guys were making the mid-level exception. That's what they were making. And so here's the thing. I think D'Lo, if D'Lo opts out, right now, I think he's on the books for $19 million next year, or like $18.5 million next year. So
18.7,
like, yeah. Yeah. So like if some team offers him 3 years for 36 or 2 years for 25 or something, like 2 years for 24, whatever it is, that the MLE, I think that'll be a deal that he potentially looks to take, because I think after next year, it's possible that he enters into the veteran minimum contract territory if it, like, with some of his limitation, right? But like, I don't know that he'll get 20 to 25. Maybe he will. But like, if I'm looking at D'Lo as an asset league-wide next year, I'm looking at him as a sixth man, a guy that is clearly not in my top five, so that I know that when push comes to shove, I'm closing with my closing group. But I can make some night-to-night calls with him with his minutes based on whether or not he's engaged in hitting shots. And more importantly, I'm using him as a regular season innings eater. So I think there's some value there. But yeah, I think I agree with you entirely. If you're a serious basketball team, you cannot have this guy in your top five players. You just can't. Like, it just, he doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. And like, I thought the best example of that was him talking about Derek White before the season as his own little player comp, and then his lack of attention to detail in the margins of the game during this postseason run. Like, I think it could not be more stark, the difference between what he's actually doing on the floor and the game that he talks. And I think that that goes to show you that there's actually a disconnect mentally between where D'Lo needs to improve and where D'Lo thinks he needs to improve. And I think those are going to be areas that kind of hold him back. Moving on to the offseason. So obviously the Lakers have a lot of questions to address. I want to start with Darvin. So here's the thing. I don't think Darvin is responsible for the Lakers losing to Denver. I do think he's responsible for the Lakers having ended up as the seventh seed. I've said this on the record, but like, I think his mistakes with the rotation in late December and early January probably cost the Lakers 3-4 games in the standings. Even if it's just 2 or 3 games, you're out of the play-in. So like, I think they would have been in that Clippers, Mavs, Suns, Wolves kind of tier there in the, or I should say Clippers, Suns, Mavs tier in that 4-6 range, right? And I think that is fair criticism of Darvin. I think the reason they lost to Denver is Denver's a better basketball team. That said, I do think you saw some of the jarring elements of Darvin kind of being in over his head in this series. Example number one, Mike Malone, super active coaching on the sidelines. Accountability with his players. Every time someone makes a mistake, he's screaming at him. He's yelling. There's accountability. There's active coaching on the sidelines. Darvin is very much passive, staying in their hands in his pockets. He's very much like a positive kind of motivator type of guy, right? And which by the way, just like you, there's a certain intensity and verve that you're expecting from the players. And I think it makes sense that the coach kind of matches that. Watch Eric Spoelstra on the sideline. How is he coaching? How animated is he? Watch Greg Popovich on the sideline. How animated is he? Watch, you know, Tyronn Lue on the sideline. Watch these guys on the sideline, and you'll see the difference in just their overall level of engagement with the team compared to what Darvin brings. Secondly, just a basketball ideology that doesn't match your personnel. I'm a big believer in like, a coach has to be very careful with his individual ideologies, inflicting them on a roster if the roster is not capable of it. So for instance, Darvin's kind of obsession with speed, quickness, and skill at the guard position and kind of leaning into that. That's not the strength of this roster. They do not have a guard core that is particularly fast, that is particularly good defensively, and that is star caliber and offensive creation. And so all you're really doing is playing a bunch of small guys that can't defend and can't score. And he had athletes on the roster. He had options that he could go there. One of the biggest strengths of this Laker roster, they got some big athletes, Rui, LeBron, AD, Jackson Hayes. He could have leaned into those lineups as much as possible. And I thought him kind of leaning into, again, we always talk about adversity brings out like the true nature of who you are as a person. And like, here we were, game 3, all the chips are down, and he benched Jackson and he played a bunch of 3-guard lineups. So that's a pretty strong indicator of where he's at there. And then lastly, like, I thought, and you know, you and I were talking about this a little bit in the before we started recording today, but like, yeah, it was bullshit that when AD made a comment that was clearly in a moment of frustration, that was clearly not aimed at anybody in particular, I thought it was just like a – I thought the comment about us not knowing what we're doing on either end of the floor, I thought it was more directed at, like, some of the role players and, like, just them going off script and not sticking to the game plan and not doing their jobs. And, yeah, I'm sure there was some criticism levied towards Darvin there. I thought it was just kind of like a general frustration with not being a serious basketball team because, like LeBron said after the game last night, LeBron and AD know they've won together. They know what it's like to be a serious team and to make a deep run. And so they are frustrated because they know this team doesn't have it. And then for Darvin to come out in the, what was it, the shoot around yesterday, and then to basically be like, yeah, we're going to agree to disagree on that and we take great pride and like basically cover his ass rather than just simply saying like, yeah, AD's pissed off. I'm pissed off too. Which would have been a perfectly normal response there. And so I don't blame Darvin for the Lakers losing to the Nuggets. That said, I don't think he's a championship-level coach. And so I do think the Lakers are going to have to address that in this offseason. They're going to have to make a move in that specific area. Where do you think the organization is right now in terms of the coaching situation? Is there some internal frustration?
Yeah. They are frustrated and disappointed with how this series has gone and with how this season has gone. I think there has been an acknowledgement that Denver is just a better team and this is a bad matchup for the Lakers. But to your point, that they shouldn't have even been in this position in the first place. And the fact that they finished as a 7 seed and had to play Denver in the first round was a reflection of mistakes earlier in the season. And I go back to early January when the Lakers lost 4 consecutive games. And I had the report with Shams Charania of The Athletic. And I came on this show and we talked about it, of the disconnect within the locker room between the players and the coaching staff and the frustration with lineups and rotations and just the identity of the team not necessarily aligning with the player's strengths. And those are all things you just hit on. And those are all things that never went away. Like they got better for periods. I think winning can paper over some frustrations and some disagreements internally. And that's why you'll see like Kobe and Shaq cannot get along, but they are so talented and Phil Jackson is such a great coach. And like they had the right role players where you can still win championships despite not being on the same page and having internal discord. But that only covers you for so long when you run into a team that is better than you and is embarrassing you. And really like the Lakers have been embarrassed in this matchup with Denver. I think like it's not just losing 11 straight games, but it's losing them the manner in which they lose them. It's completely falling apart in second halves. And I don't think that's on Darvin. And I don't think people are putting that entirely on Darvin, but I have heard conversations with people once again referencing the 3-guard lineups or Torian Prince at the 4 and just them not lean. Like there had been a shift in early February where they went back or you know they started Rui, they started leaning into the bigger lineups because all year the lineup data has said if you go big with the front court, the Lakers win those minutes. If you go
the data
small
was
with
undeniable.
Front court, it's undeniable. Like it's facts over feelings, right? Like that's been the motto of the last couple of years is facts over feelings. And the facts have been there. And the facts have been Lakers play bigger. They are better. Lakers play smaller. They are worse. Yet, as you've said, in big moments this season, even going back to parts of the Pelicans games in the regular season finale and the play-in matchup, they've gone small. And it just like there's clearly been a lack of trust for Jackson, for Rui. Like I know Rui did not have a good game last night, but Rui should not have played 28 minutes. Like there's no, in my opinion, credible argument for playing Rui 28 minutes in an elimination game or essentially elimination game when the two alternatives are playing Jackson, who's worse, and they just didn't even play him, or just going super small with more Torian and more 3-guard lineups. And like that just it doesn't work against the Denver Nuggets. Like we already went through the head-to-head matchups of how they are smaller and less physical and less forceful at each position. And then playing smaller leans into that even more. So I think, you know, I would not put this loss on him per se, but I think this loss has revealed some of his stubbornness and some of his weaknesses as a coach. And from my understanding, I think the series is likely over in four or five games, and I would probably lean toward four. Lakers are going to have some reevaluating to do in the next few days in terms of the direction of the franchise. Can Darvin lead them to the next level? And because again, as I just said in the D'Lo segment, like the Denver Nuggets aren't going anywhere. If the Lakers want to win a championship, and who knows how much longer they have with LeBron, could be a year, could be 2 years, could be 3 years, who knows? Could be 0 years. He could leave this summer. If they want to win a championship and are serious about that with LeBron and AD, I think they have to look at the future of D'Lo, Darvin, and really just some of the peripheral pieces here. So from my understanding, they are going to be reevaluating things in the next few days, looking at where this season went wrong, where this series went wrong, and then having to make potentially some tough decisions.
Attention all wrestling aficionados. Wrestling with Freddie makes its triumphant return for an electrifying fourth season. This is Freddie Prinze Jr., and I am beyond thrilled to announce that our wrestling extravaganza is back, and joining me once again is the one and only Jeff Dye.
Get ready as we highlight the most jaw-dropping matches, dissect the fiercest feuds, and uncover the latest twists and turns in the world of pro wrestling.
We're dusting off our legendary side quests and unleashing a barrage of brand new segments that will keep you guys on the edge of your seat, like our talks on Unsanctioned Thursdays.
Freddie, you know we gotta give the people what they want. This season, we have an all-star lineup of special guests who are gonna be gracing our podcast, bringing with them their own unique insights, experiences, and all of that in the world of pro wrestling and beyond.
Whether you're a seasoned wrestling veteran or a fresh-faced newcomer, we promise an experience like no other. So buckle up, wrestling fans. Listen to Wrestling with Freddie as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
NFL Total Access, the podcast, is getting you ready for the 2024 NFL Draft. I'm your host, Andrew Levy, and I'll be delivering two shows a week to make sure you're caught up on the very latest NFL news, including every free agency move and how it changes the draft needs of your favorite team. Draft experts and talent scouts, mock drafts, and a few shock drafts, too. NFL Total Access, the podcast, is already on the clock on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, the Taurean Prince piece to me is the kind of like the bellwether for where this team could have gone in terms of an identity. You mentioned the size was the primary source of success for this lineup all year long, right? Taurean Prince at the four next to three guards versus Taurean Prince at the two, which was always a look they could have gone to. Like, D'Lo is not playing well. You could literally go AD, LeBron, Rui, who Rui can play in the five out. Taurean Prince, who, here's the thing, I think Taurean Prince all season has been more like the seventh or eighth best player on the team. But within the context of this series, he was the most confident and successful bench player. So, like,
a good series.
You make a read within this context of these first two games going into game three, and it's like, okay, Torian's my one guy off the bench that's like really playing confidently and well when he comes into the game. So like, if D'Lo's not playing well, like, I would have just slotted Taurean at the two. I would have gone with Austin and Taurean with Rui, LeBron, and AD. That lineup hasn't played a single minute in this series. So like, that by the way, has been your five best players within this series. Like, Taurean's not one of your five best players, but within this series, that's your five best players. They never saw the floor. But it's because of a basketball philosophy that Darvin was trying to inflict on his roster rather than trying to cater a basketball philosophy to the strengths of his roster. And again, like, it's not about blaming him necessarily. It's more just about acknowledging the reality that, like, if you're going to continue to try to win with the LeBron and AD build, he's not up to the challenge. And they're going to have to address that in this offseason. So before we get into, we're going to do a little brief chat about the offseason, then we're going to get out of here. Before we actually get into the offseason, though, what is your sense behind the scenes as to where ownership in the front office is with the LeBron and AD core? Do they view this year? Because, like, here's the thing. I thought last year LeBron and AD got soundly outplayed by Jokic and Murray, and that was the major difference, right? This year, AD has gone toe-to-toe with Jokic. And LeBron, like, I think, because here, Murray hasn't shot well, and LeBron has had some bad stretches too. I think LeBron and Murray have been more or less the same. You know, Murray obviously hit the biggest shot of the series in game two, but LeBron was incredible down the stretch of that game. So, like, and it certainly wasn't LeBron's fault that they lost that game, right? So, like, I view the star matchup as relatively even in this series so far through three games. It's been the role players that have gotten, you know, demolished. So where is the Laker front office and ownership group, in your opinion, in terms of their optimism around giving another shot to the LeBron and AD core?
From my understanding, that is the plan. They want to keep LeBron James and sign him, either re-sign, you know, he has the option to either opt out and re-sign, or he can extend. So that is still their goal moving forward in terms of having LeBron for at least another 2 years, maybe 3 years, and going forward with this LeBron AD core. But from my understanding, it's been similar to the approach at the trade deadline in terms of you have three paths. You can run it back and keep largely the same group together, which I think would be a mistake based on how this series has gone and really how the season has gone overall. Two is you can do a like small to medium upgrade in terms of maybe that's flipping D'Lo with a pick or two picks for a first, you know, a starting, you know, lineup upgrade. And maybe you bring in a Caruso, you know, Caruso type, not necessarily Caruso, but maybe Caruso. But like you do more of like a marginal upgrade in terms of you add a new starter and maybe like a key bench guy, and you sort of run it back, but you are making a couple of upgrades. And then path number three is let's go star hunting and let's go get a Trae Young. We'll see what happens with Donovan Mitchell in Cleveland. It looks like they're going to make at least the conference semifinals, but there's been a lot of buzz about him not staying in Cleveland. And then what happens with Dallas and the Clippers, and does Dallas lose in the first round? And now we've talked about it before, but like, do they go in a different direction and pivot away from Kyrie and Luka as a pairing? And then there will likely be other stars that potentially come available. Like, I think Mikal Bridges is an interesting name of like what direction is Brooklyn going in? And he's kind of in between path number two and path number three. But for the most part, like, those are the three directions that, from my understanding, the Lakers are weighing. It sounded more recently like they are in between path number one and path number two, and we're trying to lean away from the three-star build, although there's been a lot of Trae Young buzz with them. But I don't see how you can do path number one. I don't see how you can run this back. If you run this back, you are once again a Denver matchup away from just losing whenever you face them. Like, this team is not, if Rui, D'Lo, Austin, they can all come back better, and I still don't think they could beat Denver. And even if you add like a better bench player, I still don't think you can beat Denver. So I think it's between path number two and path number three. If I had to pick one, I would probably lean more toward the marginal upgrade, and that likely being D'Lo and Rui potentially moving. Those are the most movable contracts that they have. I think they're going to try and keep Austin, but again, they're in a tough spot because on top, like, D'Lo's got a player option. Cam Reddish, Christian Wood, and Jackson Hayes all have player options. I think you can argue that they're still all minimum players. Like, maybe Jackson has outplayed it to like a mini mid-level, you know, $4 to $5 million player, but I'm not even sold on that. He just was a DNP CD in a playoff game. Christian Wood and Cam Reddish, I think, are both, you know, clearly minimum guys. So like, those guys are probably opting in. Max Christie's a restricted free agent. So like, the Lakers already have a bunch of money committed to the core of this group: LeBron, AD, Austin, Rui, Vando, Gabe Vincent. Then you add in some of these guys that can opt in, and like, they're kind of limited in terms of what they could do in free agency. And then when it comes to trading, it's going to have to be D'Lo, Rui, maybe Austin, depending on, you know, who's involved. But they're kind of limited in terms of like what they can actually do. So while I think they'd love to do path number two or path number three, it ultimately might come down to like how the trade market plays out, how free agency plays out, and some factors that are ultimately out of their control.
Yeah, I think it comes down to it's got to be a two-way offensive player rather than just an offensive player. So like I think they definitely need a high-level offensive player because LeBron and AD during the regular season just don't have the ability to put the foot down to the pedal and impact the game athletically for 82 the way that they used to offensively. I obviously am such a huge believer in those two in the context of the playoffs, but you know, within the regular season, 82, they need to get a high level offensive player. But to me, the perfect kind of like line of delineation in terms of this archetype is like the Trae Young versus DeJounte Murray type of thing. And I'm not saying that those two players are the only options, as you just laid out so many good options, but like Trae Young is a player that has a significantly higher offensive ceiling than DeJounte Murray. But DeJounte Murray, like no doubt within the context of a LeBron and AD pairing, is going to be a more impactful playoff player and a more useful playoff player with a higher floor, right? And so that's kind of what I look at. Like that's why I like the idea of a Mikal Bridges. That is an athlete that can really impact the game with a high floor, but that also has the ability to run action and be a guy that could run two-man game with LeBron and you know, that sort of thing. There's a lot of different upside to that type of pairing, right? So like, I think that's going to be the key for them is I think they need to target a legitimate two-way player to put in that two or three spot, which is something we've been talking about all day I'm here, really. But like, I'm a big believer in Austin. I think a big part of what led to Austin's poor offensive series was the fact that last year in the postseason, it was Dennis Schroeder that was taking most of the high leverage defensive assignments. And Austin was able to focus his energy in his best skill, which is, you know, being an offensive skill guard, right? And this year, that's not the case. And to his credit, I think he actually was a really useful perimeter defender for the Lakers over the last couple of years. And I think that will serve him well in lower leverage assignments throughout the rest of his career. But you got to find a way to free him up to focus on the offensive end. And the only way you're going to do that is if you bring in a real high leverage athlete at the two and the three. I like Rui at the three in the sense that like it does bring a big physical imposition to the game, but there's something to be said about having two forwards like LeBron and Rui that aren't necessarily great screen navigators or that can move their feet on the perimeter. And so that to me is going to be like the area of opportunity, essentially turning D'Lo and Rui into more compatible players at that position. DeJounte Murray is a player that I'd really like for them to take another look at. I know that the Hawks are going to be considering blowing up things this summer. I just think he could be relatively affordable compared to some of the other options out there. Obviously, Donovan Mitchell would be a home run. If you get Donovan Mitchell, you're celebrating for a long time after that. But I just think that there's going to be a big market for him.
Yeah.
And like the idea of maybe three first round picks and filler, I don't think necessarily is going to be able to compete with some of the other offers that are out there. Especially when there's so many teams that feel like they're close, right? But we'll see. Like you said, there's so many things that can happen over the next month. Like the Suns could have a catastrophe. The Mavs could have a catastrophe. The Bucks could have a catastrophe. Like there's so many different negative things that could happen over the next month. And that's going to color what ends up being the strategy. All right. Last note before we get out of here. Do you think there's any chance that LeBron James looks another direction this offseason?
I think there's always a chance. So I would say there's a small chance, but everything I've heard has been that LeBron wants to remain a Laker and that the Lakers want him to remain a Laker. And that's why they're willing to pay and commit, you know, 2 to 3 year deal or 2 to 3 year extension for, you know, $50+ million annually to keep LeBron, despite not knowing this. Like we're in uncharted territory with LeBron, right? Like it's going to be year 22, year 23, year 24, depending on how long he resigns. And like we've seen even Hall of Fame, top 10, top 20 level guys, at some point later in your career, there's the off season that you just fall off randomly. And I think based on LeBron's track record, that's not going to happen. And he's likely going to go out on a high note. And you know, whenever he decides to retire, it'll just be he's still a really good basketball player and maybe not quite top 5 or top 10 or whatever, but he'll still be a high level star level basketball player. But within that, like, the Lakers are, you know, willing to commit to that. So I think the thing with LeBron is going to be, and we've touched on this before, but if he's had his way, I think this team would have a third star, whether it was last season or this season. He was a big proponent for Kyrie Irving. I'm told he was a proponent for DeJounte Murray and Zach LaVine earlier in the season. So he's clearly, on some level, wanted a third star and that third player who could help alleviate some of the offensive burden, a player that similar to what you were just talking about. So I wonder, like, now that he has some of the power back in terms of he has a say on his future and the direction of the Lakers, like, how much does he yield that, right? And if we see the team make a change at the coaching position and then go get a third star, I think it's kind of showing like LeBron, the power is sort of back, and that he is an influential force in terms of the direction of the team. And it's sort of like what we've done the last couple of years has not worked. And, you know, yes, we made the conference finals and, you know, that was a nice run and we had a nice turnaround this year, but like, we have not been at a championship level. And with LeBron, historically, when he doesn't feel like his team is at a championship level, he wants wholesale changes. And more often than not, it has worked, right? Like, he's won a championship everywhere he's been. But I think for the Lakers, it's again, kind of, you know, I'm just interested to see how much they actually allow him to yield that this offseason. If it is a power struggle at all, maybe it won't be. Maybe it's as simple as, if you're willing to re-sign or extend, we will do XYZ to keep you happy. And we know the Lakers are a franchise that prides itself on keeping their stars happy and being partners with their stars. But I don't think that has necessarily been the case in terms of like personnel moves as much the last couple of years. And I think if you start to see the team go in a different direction, maybe a more drastic direction, that to me is a sign that he is more so getting what he's wanted compared to the last couple of years. So I think he now has some leverage over the Lakers that he did not have at the trade deadline. He did not have last year. And I'm interested to see just how all that shakes out, because it has been too, like, I don't think they've always seen eye to eye, I'll just say, over the last couple of years. And now that he has some of the power back, I want to see how that all plays out.
Yeah, selfishly, as a LeBron fan, I want him to leave, mainly just because I feel like the Lakers have let him down in a big way. I understand that he pushed for the Russell Westbrook trade, but it didn't take a basketball savant to realize that was a bad idea in the moment. You know, like, I can't think of a trade that was more universally panned at the moment and then immediately ended up being a disaster. Like from game one of that season, you were like, oh no. You're like,
I think they're still paying for it right now. Like, I think this course, all of this has been compounding mistakes since the Russell Westbrook trade.
We talked about a small mistake that could have been undone that could have saved some of this heartache in the Alex Caruso situation. But there's no doubt, if you're pointing to one singular incident that was the downfall of the Los Angeles Lakers, it was the Russell Westbrook trade. Not Russell Westbrook. I mean, Russell Westbrook was always Russell Westbrook, and that evidence was there. And so I don't necessarily blame him for coming into the Lakers and being Russell Westbrook and it being a bad idea, right? Like, that was on the there's just no universe where any serious front office would have watched film of Russell Westbrook and been like, this is a good idea, let's do this. Like, there's just no universe where that would have been the case. So, like, When you're giving up a draft asset, you're like, if I remember correctly, the Buddy Hield trade was, I want to say, Kuzma, Harrell, and a pick. So they would have kept KCP. They would have kept KCP. Like, it would have been a substantially better. And Kuzma, by the way, kind of like Rui, was a redundancy with LeBron. And so there was some concern as to whether or not that was really a good fit to begin with. But like, pivoting to Russ, which forced them to include KCP, that was really the downfall of everything. And, you know, between letting Caruso go, between signing Talen Horton-Tucker, which, by the way, I had no real problem with signing Talen Horton-Tucker. It was signing Talen Horton-Tucker without retaining Alex Caruso that I thought was a disaster. Between all the mistakes that Magic Johnson made in the early phase of his president of basketball operations kind of stint there. Like, this was a team that should have been a conference finalist year in, year out for a 4-year period. And instead they got one additional conference finals trip off the tail of an incredible defensive run from Anthony Davis, right? And so it just kind of felt like a waste. So part of me wishes LeBron would leave just because I want to see him play in a competent environment and give it a real shot. But I agree with you in the sense that, like, I just have a hard time believing he will. As far as the building thing goes, it's so funny because over the last couple of years, like in the 2021, 2022, 2023 off seasons, it was like, don't go star hunting. Just get a quality role player. Just go get some athletes that can help LeBron and AD. But like, now that we're tilting into the later portion of LeBron's career, now we've been in the later portion, but now that we're into the preposterously late portion of LeBron's career, year 22, like, you almost have to go star hunting because, like, simply put, like, part of the issue is I think LeBron could have a really useful year 22, year 23, if he can pick his spots. But he could not pick his spots on this team. They desperately needed him to be great. And to his credit, he was. Post-deadline, he was the only player in the NBA to average at least 27 on 50% from the field and 40% from three. He was one of only three players in the league this year to average at least 25, 7, and 7. I legitimately think, like, he was bad in game three. He was bad in game three. There's no way around it. He dropped the ball on the defensive end. He let his team down. But outside of that game, pretty much for the last 2 or 3 months, he's been playing at a top five level. And legitimately, it's ridiculous that they needed him to be that. If they could have managed this in a way that lessened his workload and kept him in a position where he could pick his spots, there's a version of this where this could be sustained success. And so obviously there's always going to be a part of me that wonders what would have happened if he was in a more competent situation. But if he stays, I think at this point you have to start looking for higher firepower guys that can lessen his workload. All right, we've gone for an hour already, so we're going to get out of here. Yovan, why don't you tell us what you guys are working on over at The Athletic right now?
Yeah, so I will be monitoring this whole situation in terms of the sweep and the fallout, or the potential sweep. Freudian slip there. The potential sweep and all the fallout from it, all the off-season stuff. We'll have a big piece at The Athletic coming out whenever the season ends, so be on the lookout for that. And also be sure to check out my YouTube channel. Just search Yovan Buha, Jovan Buha. I have my podcast there, Buha's Block. I'm doing post-game reactions after every game, and then I will also be reacting to whatever happens with this offseason, going directly to YouTube and doing reaction videos there. So be sure to check that out and subscribe if you have not done so yet.
All right, guys, that is all we have for today. As always, we sincerely appreciate you guys for supporting the show. We're going to have Yovan on a bunch of times over the course of the stretch right after the postseason when we get into the draft and free agency and everything like that. We are taking tonight off. I'm dealing with a personal family matter. Tomorrow morning, we'll have a breakdown of tonight's games. And then Saturday night, we'll be going live after the final buzzer of Lakers Nuggets. I will see you guys then.
It's Freddie Prinze Jr. and Jeff Dye back in the ring. Wrestling with Freddie makes its triumphant return for an electrifying fourth season. Hey, Jeff, are you ready to rumble our way into an all-new season of Wrestling with Freddie?
You better believe I have. I've been practicing my body slams, and I'm jacked.
All right, don't go injuring yourself now. We'll be highlighting the best stories and matches of the week in wrestling from AEW, WWE, and have one-on-one talks with the best talents in the world of pro wrestling.
Listen to Wrestling with Freddie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We're the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network,
available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.